Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about today, including a conversation with the head of the St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force, Dr. Alexander Garza, about his volunteering to test a possible COVID-19 vaccine. We'll also find out about some new guidelines for cervical cancer screening and hear about a new way to treat carotid arteries. But first, let's get started the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again today. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing fine, thanks. Let's start out by finding out about the local census. What are we hearing and what are you seeing when it comes to patients in the St. Louis area?
Yeah, you know, it's remarkably steady. We still get roughly the same number of patients, I think, diagnosed in the community. I've been kind of touting this number. It's been hovering around 500 new cases a day. It may have dipped a little bit according to the analysis I follow most closely, but I think that's really more noise and a meaningful trend. So, I mean, we still have, you know, consistent transmission, consistent new infections, the same kind of consistent numbers in the hospital. You know, it goes up and down throughout the weeks, but it's been more or less steady.
Here's how Dr. Anthony Fauci is seeing things these days.
I just think we need to hunker down and get through this fall and winter because it's not going to be easy. We know every time we lift restrictions, we get a blip. I mean, it's whack-a-mole.
You agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And I think going into the fall and the winter, we've had unbelievable weather, particularly this summer. It's been pleasant for the most part. We could do things outside. If you wanted to go to a restaurant, you could do that outside. And what, in my mind, I think is a safer experience. You know, once the weather starts to turn and we're more wrapped up indoors, you know, that to me is really the mystical question that we need to find out. And I think it's certainly cause for concern. And I think I saw this week Florida was starting to open up restaurants and bars again and removing restrictions. And you're just, we seem to be making progress and doing the right things. And we say, okay, that's good enough. And then let's get back to normal. And it's just, that's the wrong approach, frankly. And I know it's been people struggle with their businesses. And I absolutely understand that. But we're actually hurting ourselves more by this less disciplined approach. It makes it last longer, whereas other countries are starting to recover, and that's the frustration.
Dr. Buchholz, I wanted to ask you about in-home testing and what the challenges are there.
Yeah, you know, it's complicated, and we've talked multiple times before, Fred, about testing, and you know, there's this concept called false positives and false negatives, and that can lead to mistakes, and doctors make these mistakes too. So, in fact, they're notorious for making these mistakes. Pretty much all the tests are really looking for DNA samples or DNA material from coronavirus. So once they have the adequate material and the DNA is there on the cotton swab or whatever it is used to get the sample, the test will reliably find it. So it's certainly, if you have it, you do the test correctly, and you get a portion of that DNA, it's going to capture that and be very, very accurate. That is absolutely correct. So once you have that positive test, you can be pretty confident that you have coronavirus, you know, this novel COVID-19. The trick and the issue is a negative test. What a negative test says is that they do not detect the DNA. So, you now run in this panoply of questions. Do I not have the disease, which is what most people would interpret from getting that? But there's going to be a large percentage of people that have the disease, maybe asymptomatic carriers, that either A, they didn't do the test correctly, or they just didn't collect enough material, or, you know, a variety of other reasons why the test may be negative. And those are what we call those false negatives. In the hospital setting, the false negatives are what we worry about because, you know, we may do a test that may be negative, and then they're up on the hospital floor. Our nurses and physicians and all the other people involved with caring for the patient are seeing that patient without the right personal protective equipment. And if they're a false negative and they really have disease, we now expose a huge number of people. And you can just see how quickly that devolves into exposing a whole bunch of other people, all the families of those healthcare practitioners, all the other patients that they see. That's how coronavirus runs away so quickly. So we've got to be super paranoid about the false negative tests. I've had a couple of patients that clearly had coronavirus. They tested negative, and I'm like, I don't care. We're still going to treat them as such because A, I don't want to expose our healthcare workers, and B, I want to make sure that they're in isolation and that they're protected too, and they follow quarantine when I discharge them from the hospital. When you do this on a mass scale, the number of false negatives tends to go up, and can lead people to either false assurances or not doing the proper things they need to do, which is, you know, wear their face mask, stay away from others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's nice to do. It's better to have it than not to have it. But, you know, they're helpful for the fact that when they're positive, you can at least isolate and identify those people. They're not helpful very much when they're negative. That's the drawback with that we've got to be a little cautious with.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, a new study from the CDC shows adults with COVID-19 are about twice as likely to say they've dined at a restaurant. What are you seeing?
Yeah, and again, this goes back to, you know, information we've now known for a number of months, frankly, is, you know, particularly inside confined spaces where there's circulating air and not much ventilation or inadequate ventilation, even with social distancing, people spread out, that the air can really rapidly circulate coronavirus, particularly the longer you're in that particular facility. And you know, certainly more close proximity or not wearing face masks kind of increase that risk. And then you see that in results. I mean, Florida's kind of infamous now of people deciding not to follow this guidance, going to a happy hour or a restaurant that was crowded and indoor, and then you know, a large number of people became infected very, very quickly. And again, it's one thing if, you know, 10 people get infected, you isolate and quarantine them and get them, reduce their exposure to others. But more often than not, because it takes about 5 days to get symptoms, those individuals have exposed a whole host of other people. And that's where it ran away. And you know, Florida became the epicenter for a while. And so that's this issue that I keep on talking about. And many people that have dealt with this are worried about it. It's not going to a park per se. It's not exercising per se. It's not, you know, doing things outside. It's in these confined spaces inside where particularly air conditioning or heat is blowing air and it's circling around in that room. That's what seems to be the most reliably consistent way this is spread. And, you know, as we enter cooler weather, that's, I think, the risk everybody that's responsible for dealing with is concerned about.
Dr. Buchholz, I'm seeing this a lot these days when I'm out at a grocery store. Some people are wearing their mask only covering their mouth. Tell us about the dangers of what's called half masking.
Yeah, well, you're not covering the nose. And, you know, the nose is probably where more of this lives than in the mouth. You know, again, the standard test for coronavirus right now is a nasopharyngeal swab. We stick a long Q-tip, you know, in your nose to basically the back of the nose. And that's where we get our reliable sample. So, you know, if you're not covering your nose, you're really not doing the job. It's almost pointless to have a face mask on altogether. And I cringe every time I see it. You know, particularly if I see a food delivery worker with a mask over their mouth, I'm actually walking away. I just don't trust it. And, you know, I tend not to say something to people about it because I don't know if that's my Midwestern politeness or what, but I'm just less upfront about it. But it's certainly, if the nose isn't covered, it's you might as well not wear the mask at all. And that's not to say don't wear a mask. Wear the mask and cover your nose.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Fred, for allowing me to have a voice in this. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk with Dr. Alexander Garza, the chief medical officer for SSM Health. He's volunteered to take part in a COVID-19 vaccine trial underway at St. Louis University. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The head of the St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force, Dr. Alexander Garza, who's also the chief medical officer for SSM Health, has volunteered to take part in a COVID-19 vaccine trial now underway at St. Louis University's Center for Vaccine Development. It's the Moderna vaccine being tested there. Dr. Garza joins us now on the phone. Dr. Garza, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Why did you volunteer for the vaccine trial, Dr. Garza?
Well, it was a couple of reasons, Fred. So one is, I advocate for vaccinations, universally. So childhood vaccinations, influenza vaccinations, because they provide so much good for the community. They protect people against disease. They save lives. And by and large, they're very safe. And so one of the things that I was wanting to do was to let people know, like, hey, I advocate for these vaccines, and I'm willing to put skin in the game to show that these vaccines go through these rigorous trials, these safety trials, and these efficacy trials to prove that they work. And so I felt if I was going to be a spokesperson for advocating for vaccines, that I should put myself in the game and show people that yes, these trials really are very well done to ensure that they're safe and effective for the public. And then the second piece, I think, is it's just it's my way of contributing to the science of the vaccine as well. We each have to do our part. Some of us do some things like participating in vaccine research trials. Some of us do other things providing for our neighbors or our community. So I thought this was my small way of contributing to the science.
So tell us about the experience. What went on?
Yeah. It's not too complex of a process. So I went online and on SLU's website, the Vaccine Research Center, and entered in my information. I was randomly chosen to participate in the trial. And so from there, then you have to go through all of the paperwork and all of the legalese of participating in a research trial, such as something called an informed consent. So you walk through, hey, these are all of the risks that you're taking with participating in a vaccine trial. These are all the things that we'll need you to do. This is the follow-up that you'll have, things like that. So once you get the paperwork done, which takes a fair amount of time because, you want to ensure that everybody understands what's going on. But you get through the paperwork, there's a physical exam that's involved, draw some blood. And then at the end of all of that process, there's an interview as well to make sure, your medical history is well documented, all of those things. And at the end of the process, really the very last thing is receiving a shot. And since it's a blinded study, which means nobody knows except for the person who's physically taking the syringe out of the pharmacy, whether it's vaccine or not. So I may have gotten vaccine or I may have gotten a placebo. And then what goes on from there is be followed for 2 years, looking for any, side effects, if I feel ill, if I'm running a fever, things like that. And then periodically I will go back to St. Louis University to have more medical checks, more blood drawn, more questions asked, things like that. And that's pretty routine for how vaccines get developed. We want to make sure that there's no long-term effects and that things aren't happening that shouldn't be happening, and things that are happening that should be happening are occurring as well.
Dr. Garza, how important is this phase 3 testing?
Well, it's very important. And so, phase 1 and phase 2 look at safety, and then they also look at optimizing the dose. Phase three is really to show how effective the vaccine is going to be sort of in the real world. And so you take a group of people and you vaccinate one group with the vaccine and the other group with a placebo, and then you sort of send them out into the wild, so to speak. And then by checking up on them every so often, you see whether the vaccine was protective against the virus or not. And so that's why you follow people over time and you get blood drawn and things like that to see if you had been exposed, whether you developed antibodies, all of those things. And then if you had any of those, any of those symptoms from having COVID. And so it's especially important to go through sort of this larger phase to gain that understanding on how effective the vaccine is really in the real world.
We're talking with Dr. Alexander Garza. Dr. Garza is the chief medical officer for SSM Health and the head of the St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force. Dr. Garza, what's your reaction to AstraZeneca halting its phase three vaccine trial earlier this week due to one adverse patient reaction?
Yeah, so I heard that on the news as well. Apparently, there was a participant in the trial that had developed some sort of medical condition or some symptoms that the researchers running the trial felt it was the most prudent step would be to stop the trial until they figured out whether the health condition that this person experienced was a result of the vaccine or not. But this happens often in vaccine and in drug trials. And so I don't think that this is, you know, something strange or different from the development of any sort of pharmaceutical. And it's an appropriate thing to do as well. And so I think that's an important piece to point out, is that they did do the right thing by halting the trial until they could get to the answer on whether the person's condition was a result of the vaccine or not. But certainly not anything that people would not expect for doing research like this.
What do you think is a realistic timeline for a possible vaccine?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that seems to be, you know, what's burning on everybody's mind. Just in my discussions with some of the researchers and other people that I think have a fairly good grasp on this, I think the best that we can hope for, and this isn't going to be, vaccine for the masses all delivered at one time. And so I think that's important to point out, is there's not just going to be a truckload full of vaccine that's going to show up. It's going to come out in batches as the production ramps up. So what I think is a fair estimate is there will be small amounts coming out by the end of the year. By then, most of the phase three trials will be either done or close to being completed, and the government will have enough data to decide whether to release the vaccine or not. And then the vaccine will be offered to people at risk. So that would be healthcare workers or other people that might have increased risk of exposure or poor outcomes from COVID. And so I think it's going to be a pretty small population that's going to be vaccinated at the beginning. I don't believe that there will be enough production capacity to be able to do wide mass vaccinations or vaccinations for the general public until really spring of 2021 or late spring, early summer. That's my best guess.
Dr. Garza, a couple quick questions for you about flu shots, since we're at that mm-hmm. time of year. How important is mm-hmm. it to get a flu shot during this COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, extremely important. And a couple of reasons for that. So one is, it's very difficult to distinguish between influenza and COVID just based on symptoms. They're both respiratory viruses, and so they're both going to cause similar symptoms with fever and cough and muscle aches and things like that. And so if there's some way that we can protect against one of those viruses, then that's a good thing. The second one is, there is documentation of co-infection with coronavirus and with influenza. Now, how much of an impact that has on a person, we don't know yet. But still, being co-infected, especially if you're a person at risk, most likely puts you in an even higher risk category. And so anything that we can do to mitigate other things that can cause an increase in morbidity and mortality, such as getting influenza vaccinated, we should be doing. So it will definitely help out with protecting the public. It'll help out with hospitalizations. All of those things are the benefits for getting the flu vaccine.
What do you mean by co-infection?
Yeah, so there are cases where patients can be infected both with the coronavirus, the virus that the SARS-CoV virus 2 that causes COVID, and with the influenza virus. And so you can be infected with both of those viruses at the same time. And as you can imagine, that it could add on to the insult to the human body if you have two respiratory viruses attacking it at one time.
Does having COVID-19 provide any immunity from the flu?
Not that we know of. The immunity question is still, I think, one that's up for debate. There was a recent study that came out of Europe that showed about 4 months of immunity for the coronavirus. So that was against coronavirus. Now, I haven't read anything or seen anything about protection against influenza. Now, obviously, there are different viruses, and they have different receptors and things like that. So I haven't read of any protective effect. Now, we still don't know how long the protection lasts for the coronavirus itself. And so it may wane after 4 months. So still a lot of questions about immunity out there.
Dr. Garza, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Anytime, Fred.
Dr. Alexander Garza is the chief medical officer for SSM Health. He's also the head of the St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll find out about some new age guidelines for cervical cancer screenings. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The American Cancer Society has changed its age guidelines for cervical cancer screenings. Here to talk with us about that is SLU Care's Dr. Leslie McCloskey. Dr. McCloskey is an OBGYN at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Dr. McCloskey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the change?
So the change is specifically by the American Cancer Society, their guidelines that say screening should start for cervical cancer at the age of 25. It's a change in age. Prior, it was starting to screen at age 21, but they're saying start at 25. And a major difference is at 25 to use primary HPV screening, so to test for the human papillomavirus or HPV virus at that age, and do that every 5 years as long as it continues to be negative.
Why the increase in age from 21 to 25?
Yeah, their recommendation is change the age to 25 based on a few things, mainly based on the fact that cervical cancer in age 21 to 24-year-olds is very rare. So that's one of their main reasons. The other reason is that as HPV vaccination rates are increasing, these individuals now are getting to the age where this is a beneficial thing, and so it is going to be less, HPV, excuse me, will be less prevalent as many people are getting the vaccine.
Tell us how cervical cancer screening is done. What sort of tests are out there?
Sure. There's different ways to do it. The traditional way has been pap smears, which is also called cytology, where they actually look at the cells from the cervix on the under the microscope in the lab. And then HPV testing or human papillomavirus testing can be used alone or can be used in conjunction with a pap smear. So you can do a pap smear alone or cytology. You can do HPV testing alone, or you can do a pap smear with HPV, and that's co-testing.
And these recommendations are changing which tests are recommended?
Yeah. So what's happened over the years is as we've learned more about the natural history of cervical cancer, we know that almost all of cervical cancers are caused by the HPV virus. And so over the years, we are able to test for this virus. And so things have changed with the testing itself as we've learned this. And so testing for HPV has actually been shown to be a much more sensitive test at picking up precancerous changes as well as cancerous changes.
Is there a recommended change in the HPV testing age limits?
Yes. So the prior to these new guidelines in 2012 by the American Cancer Society, in conjunction with a few other organizations, recommended doing cytology alone or pap smears alone between the age of 21 and 29. And these new guidelines are saying instead doing HPV testing starting at age 25 as their main recommendation.
And that's lowered the age from 30?
Correct. So it was 30 before. The prior guidelines said at age 30 to 65, the recommendation was to do co-testing, so to do a pap smear with HPV. So these new guidelines are taking the HPV testing to, from age 30 down to age 25.
Is there an upper age limit on some of these tests?
Yes. The recommendation in, again, average risk women is to stop doing pap smears at the age of 65.
We're talking with Dr. Leslie McCloskey. Dr. McCloskey is a SLU Care OBGYN at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Dr. McCloskey, how do you feel about these changes?
They are. I'm not surprised at the changes. I have been doing this for a long time, and there's been quite a bit of change that's occurred over the years. I think doing HPV testing starting at a younger age, at the age of 25, I think will be helpful in potentially lowering the risk of cancer in that age group that's between 25 and 30. Some of the concern I have with changing these guidelines and saying to start pap smears at 25 is that some women will consider that's the time at which they need to start to see a gynecologist, and that is not the case. So it's very important that women realize that it's not just about having a pap smear when they come to see us. There's a lot of other factors and a lot of other things that we take care of in women. So I want to make sure that people understand that they should still start their care earlier than that. I also am excited to see that more attention is being paid to the HPV virus, because that's the virus that causes the cervical abnormalities that we see that are precancerous and then cancerous. And I love bringing attention to the HPV vaccine as a major player in preventing or decreasing cervical cancer in our country and in the world.
Dr. McCloskey, what's the main message you want women to get out of this?
I think the main message is, again, that we know more now than we ever did before about cervical cancer screening, and that we have better tests and we have ways in which to detect things that can be an issue, and that's the HPV virus and certain HPV viruses, and that we are able to do that with the way we're screening now, and without having to do more testing, without having to potentially cause harm by doing screening that is not necessary on a yearly basis like we used to. And that I really want to make sure that our patients and that people come in for their care. Cervical cancer is completely preventable almost all of the time if people go for routine care and follow, you know, the advice that some of these guidelines will provide us.
Dr. McCloskey, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me again.
Dr. Leslie McCloskey is a SLU care OBGYN at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll find out about a new way to treat carotid arteries. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. There's a new surgical way to treat carotid arteries. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. T.J. Schneider. Dr. Schneider is a vascular surgeon at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. Dr. Schneider, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Fred.
So tell us about this new procedure.
We're very excited to be offering the newest procedure available in the area for treating carotid artery disease, which is a problem that patients develop sometimes with a narrowing of the artery in their neck, which can basically lead to stroke. So about a one-third of all the strokes in America are felt to be or known to be related to carotid artery narrowing. And this procedure is a way of doing it more safely than other carotid stent procedures and equally as safe as the old-fashioned carotid endarterectomy, which is a large incision in the neck. So this procedure is uses a very small incision in the neck, just above the collarbone, and takes about half as much time, and is truly been revolutionary in this part of vascular disease.
How new is this?
This has been under study for 5 to 10 years across the world, and but in terms of the FDA approval for this, has been out for about a year. And it's been deployed in the outside of the experimental research centers just over the last year. We were selected to be one of those sites because we were already doing carotid stenting since 2005, going through the groin up the femoral artery, which has a lot more risk because you're potentially knocking plaque off going nearby the heart on the way to the neck. And so we have been doing this since early in 2020, and have had tremendous success, and very impressed by it.
How safe is this?
This is equally as safe as carotid endarterectomy in terms of the complications. So the complications from this procedure about 1%, 1 to 1.5% chance of having a major complication, which means there's about a 98.5 to 99% chance of having success, not having a major complication. That's been the experience in the vascular centers of excellence like ours. As compared to the femoral stenting, which has up to 3 to 4% major complication rate, so that's maybe twice as many patients could have a bad outcome, which may not be reversible. So, as having a stroke in someone from having a stent or a surgery procedure could be end up being lethal or debilitating. So, this is a major improvement because we are now able to help people more safely, and hence treat more people too. In fact, this is really the preferred treatment for all patients over 80 years old, because surgery is a big deal in anybody elderly, and this is a lot less invasive and safer than any other carotid procedure in the neck. Many of the specialists that treat carotid artery disease in the neck through the groin, going through the femoral artery, are not surgeons, and so that's all they have available to them. So that's all they have to offer. We're fortunate to be able to offer all three procedures, the surgery, the safer stenting route, which is the small incision in the neck versus the femoral stenting. And so it's much safer for patients to have all those choices to kind of go over. There's pros and cons. Some people are not eligible for it because they don't have the proper anatomy. So we do a lot of testing to determine that ahead of time.
We're talking with Dr. T.J. Schneider. Dr. Schneider is a vascular surgeon at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. Dr. Schneider, tell us again, how does this revascularization work?
this procedure, it's called transcarotid arterial revascularization, or TCAR, T-C-A-R, is a procedure which is done with a small incision in the neck just above the collarbone, 1 inch or 1.5 inches wide. And we place a very small tube in the neck called a sheath, and we reverse the flow coming out of the brain so that when we're working on the narrowing, we don't knock any or, you know, break any plaque off to go into the brain. We suck the blood out through a tubing system, and we insert the filtered blood back through the groin and the femoral vein. So there's no way that anything could leak through the filter. When the patient has this procedure done through the groin, there is a filter placed up in the neck, but many pieces of particle get around that and through that. So that's why this is safer. So this is done. You know, the stent is placed while we're reversing the flow, and then we remove the tubing, the sheath, and it's over. So it takes about an hour. That's about the average time that it's taken for most centers to do this well.
Recovery time must be quicker as well.
Yes, sir. It's much quicker. They're all admitted overnight. Most of them don't know why they're admitted, because they think they feel they could go home, but that's not allowed at this point in time with Medicare, Medicaid services, and most insurances. So we keep them just out of safety as well. And boy, they're back to their normal routine much quicker than those who have had the larger carotid surgery in their neck. I have a friend who had both carotid arteries treated with surgery, and it took him a whole year to be able to get his golf game back in order, because he couldn't turn his neck. And so that doesn't even come into play here, fortunately.
How do you know if someone has carotid artery disease?
Patients have to have a diagnostic test to find out. Most of them are diagnosed with an ultrasound, a carotid artery ultrasound or carotid artery duplex scan that is ordered by a primary care physician. Some patients get screened, but most patients don't get a test unless they've had some sort of symptoms, mini stroke symptoms where they've had some weakness or some numbness or some vision trouble or some loss of memory. That's usually not a good reason to do testing, but patients get these tests when they complain about some brain symptoms to their primary care physician or the other provider. So some patients get CAT scans, CT scans with contrast to see this, MRI. But the number one, the least expensive and the least invasive there is the ultrasound, which has been the gold standard for years.
Dr. Snyder, what's your main message you want to get out?
My main message regarding TCAR is for patients to know there are other options than a major surgery, and there are other options that are done to treat them that are new, and there always will continue to be new developments in all areas of medicine, especially in the vascular world. This completes the endovascular revolution, in my view, in terms of taking away the larger incisions to help patients get the smaller incisions in the safest possible manner. So TCAR is here to stay and is something that any patient with carotid artery disease should know about and look for someone to explain to them whether or not they're a candidate or not.
Dr. Snyder, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dr. T.J. Schneider is a vascular surgeon at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the Radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.